Hi, Hank. Morning. Okay, so it's Parshas Pinchas, page 876. Just begin with a bit of an overview of the different things in this week's Parsha. I'm giving out handouts. There should be some handouts around there, so if you can grab. Here we are.
Thanks. How are you?
I'm good. So there's a number of things in the Parshas. First of all, we start with the reward of Pinchas, which came on the back of the story at the end of last week's parasha, where the Jews started to engage in immorality, and it ended with a plague, and then Pinchas stood up and killed a leading perpetrator, the leader of the tribe of Shimon, and then the plague stopped, and Pinchas was rewarded. We also have the war against Midian, because Midian was responsible for this enticing the Jewish people into sin, and therefore there was a war against Midian. We have a counting of the Jewish people. We have the dividing of the land of Eretz Yisrael. Counting of the Levim, who counted separately. We have the daughters. We have the story of the daughters of Tzlafchad, who came and their father didn't have any sons, so they were worried they wouldn't receive a portion of the land of Israel. And because of that, we get introduced some of the laws of inheritance. Then it moves on that Moshe Rabbeinu is allowed to view the holy land of Eretz Yisrael, but not allowed to enter. And then he speaks to Hashem to put in place a succession plan to make sure that there should be an appointment of a new leader. And then at the end of the parasha, we have Korbanos, the sacrifices, beginning with the daily sacrifices. And then we have a long list of Yomim Tovim, of sacrifices, the Musaf, that are brought on Rosh Chodesh and on Shabbos and on Yom Tov. In fact, Parshas Pinchas is a very Yontif Parsha, because every time on every Yontif, every Rosh Chodesh, every Yontif, every Chol HaMoed, we read a portion of Parshas Pinchas, because we always read about the special sacrifices that are brought on that particular festival, and that's why it's always Parshas Pinchas. So Parshas Pinchas is probably the most read from Parsha in the Torah, because we often, every Rosh Chodesh we read from it, every Yontif, every Rosh Chodesh, every Chol HaMoed. Also to point out, an interesting thing before we go on, that it's an exciting week, because next week is the last week that we're completely out of sync with Israel. Next week we catch up, right? Next week, not this Shabbos, but next Shabbos, we're going to read Matos and Masai. In Israel, they'll only read Masai, and then we're back together again, which is a nice thing, because it's a bit distorting or a bit like distracting when we in different pages kind of thing. I think I explained this to you a few weeks ago. One of the reasons that it takes so long to get in sync, even though there were other opportunities to get in sync until now, is because of this parsha. Because we want Parshas Pinchas to be in the 3 weeks, if we can. Meaning, in Israel this past Shabbos they read Parshas Pinchas, but it was before the fast of the 17th of Tammuz, because it was pushed off to Sunday, the fast. And for us, it's this week, so it's always, we try always to make sure that Pinchas is in the 3 weeks. The reason being, because Pinchas gives us the inspiration and the hope that we need during the 3 weeks of mourning, for a number of reasons. First of all, Pinchas, there's a famous Chazal saying that Pinchas ze Elio, that the neshama of Pinchas and the neshama of Elio Anovi is the same neshama. In fact, Pinchas is Elio, whatever that means. And Elio, of course, is the one who will usher in the good news of coming of Mashiach. We also have Chalukas Oros, we have the dividing up of the land of Eretz Yisrael, something that will take place again when Mashiach comes. And then we have all the sacrifices, which we can't do now, but we can at least learn about them. And we learn about them, we can also hope that they will come back soon through the coming of Mashiach and the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, so that's the bit of an introduction and overview to the parasha. So let's just have a look at the beginning of the parasha. Just, yeah, sure.
Pinchas, I mean, he actually committed latent murder there.
Yeah, that's correct. He did? No, he didn't commit murder. Murder.
Torah,
sorry?
Murder.
Sorry?
What gave him really the...
Okay, so let's have a look. So I'm going to share something with you that will answer your question. Okay. It's a combination of a halacha and his motive, and we'll soon see. So let's have a look at the first few psukim, page 876. And Hashem speaks to Moshe Rabbeinu, saying, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKoyen, Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron, the Kohen, Heshivas Hamasim al B'nai Yisrael, he turned back, he reversed my anger against the Jewish people. B'kanoi eskinasi b'soichem, because he was zealous for my honor, in other words, amongst them. And therefore, V'loi chilisis B'nai Yisrael, I did not destroy the Jewish people in my zealousness. Lachen emor, therefore, tell him, Hinini noisen lo esbrisi shalom, I am going to give him the covenant of peace. And he was rewarded by becoming a Kohen and his descendants being Kohanim, which wasn't the case before. The reason it wasn't the case before, I think we mentioned before, that when Aaron was made into a Kohen, it was Aaron and his sons, and all those to be born afterwards. But those that were already alive, his grandsons, did not become Kohanim. And therefore, originally Pinchas was not a Kohen, notwithstanding that he came from Aaron, because he was already alive when Aaron was turned into a Kohen. However, he was given a special reward to become a Kohen, and therefore since then, him and his descendants become Kohanim. Now, there's a famous little Rashi here about why the Torah has to tell us his whole yichus. Pinchas, son of Elazar, the son of Aaron, right? So what does that mean? So Rashi says, because, I mean, we know who Pinchas was. We know him before. We're not introduced to Pinchas now for the first time, right? So Rashi says the reason is because when this happened, right, when Pinchas did stand up. Now, just to give you a bit of background, halachic background to Pinchas' thing, just because Melanie asked the question. So the Gemara says like this: what happened was that this was this whole immorality story together with Avodah Zarah that was happening. So it was idol worship and immorality. And then there was a public display of immorality with the leader of Shimon and this princess that he picked up from Midian coming to Moshe Rabbeinu in a very, very public way with a terrible chilul Hashem. There is a halacha. It's a very strange halacha. It's a halacha in the Gemara, but the halacha, it says in the Gemara that the halacha is a halacha that you would not paskan on. In other words, the halacha exists, but if someone already asked a shayla, you wouldn't say, go ahead and do it. What's the halacha? The halacha is that haboyel aramis, that if someone has a public display of immorality, a Jew and non-Jew, in the context as it was in the time of the Chumash, and it's public, so therefore because it's public, it's what we call a chilul Hashem, it's desecrating Hashem's name, then the one who is zealous is permitted to kill them to defend Hashem's honor without due process, without a process of a trial, which is why Pinchas killed them. However, the reason that halacha is not transmitted and publicly spoken about, in other words, it's not, like if someone comes to ask you a shayla, like, you know, can I do this? It's not something you say, yeah, go ahead and do it. It's if it's done, it's permitted. Now, what does that mean? And how do we know, in other words, a person before they do that has to be sure that they can do that. And this is hinted in the Rashi, which we just explained, which we just talked about. Because Rashi says the following. Rashi says that after it happened, so he was criticized. The other tribes started to criticize him. And they say, who are you to go and just take it law into your own hands and kill him, right? And the way they criticized him was the following. This is what Rashi says. Rashi says that the Shvatim, the tribes, were criticizing him and sort of embarrassing him, and they said to him, did you see this guy who's Ben Puti? Ben Puti means he came from Yisrael. Now on his father's side, he came from Aaron HaKohen. On his mother's side, he came from Yisrael. I think his mother was a sister-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu, because Moshe Rabbeinu also married a daughter of Yisrael. Not sure exactly how, but on his mother's side, he was a descendant of Yisrael. Now Yisrael originally was a priest, an idolater, a pagan worshipper, right? So the expression goes, they said to him, you see this guy, Ben Puti, who does he think he is? Right? He's this guy who his mother's father, right? In other words, his grandfather, fattened up the calves, fattened the animals, to bring them for Avodah Zarah, for animal worship. And he goes ahead. This is the guy who's now taking the thing into his own hands and killing the two perpetrators. So therefore, the Torah says, no. Who's this? Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. He might have Yisrael on the one hand, who might used to be an idol worshipper, but he's got Aaron on the one side, right? And obviously, the obvious question is, what does this mean? Well, first of all, what do you mean he came from Yisrael? Yisrael himself was a good guy. He might have served Avodah Zarah, but he did shuvah, right? So what? So he's got good yichus and bad yichus. So how does that change anything? Is it a bad yichus? I mean, he's either allowed to do it or he's not allowed to do it. What changed, right? Second of all, the whole expression is very strange. They didn't say to him, look at this guy whose grandfather served idols, and he's taking the law into his own hands. They didn't say that. They said, look at this guy whose grandfather fattened calves for idol worship. That's a detail in idol worship. That's not idol worship. That's a component of the idol worship process. They used to bring sacrifice to idol worship. They wanted to bring nice animals, so they would stuff them. They would force feed them and stuff them up, make them sort of really fat, and then they'd have these nice animals to serve for avodah zarah, for idol worship, right? But that's just a component. Why don't they just say it straight? Look at this guy whose grandfather served idols, and he went ahead and killed on his own accord. But they didn't say it. They said, look at the guy whose grandfather fattened the calves for avodah zarah. What's that supposed to mean? So the Rebbe has an amazing chiddush on this, a beautiful idea. And he says, no, what happened was as follows. It's got nothing to do with the fact that Yisrael served avodah zarah. That's going to do with the first. He did tshuva, he was converted, he was a new person, he was a fine man, he was a tzaddik, he was Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law, he was a great person. That wasn't the issue. The issue is they were checking the personality, the DNA of Pinchas. And I said, listen, he thinks such a big tzaddik, he went ahead and killed. Maybe he killed because he's got a cruel side to him. Right? He's got a cruel side to him. That's what it is. How do we know he's got a cruel side to him? Because his grandfather must have had a cruel side to him. Because to force feed animals just to serve them as avodah zarah animal sacrifices is a cruel thing to do. It's nothing to do with idol worship. It's got to do with the treatment of animals. It wasn't even over time that they fattened the calves in order to eat. It was just a thing they would force feed these animals, make them really fat, and then shecht them for avodah zarah, for idol worship. So they said he's got it in his genes. There's obviously a cruel gene there. And that's why he went ahead and created Zimri and Cosby. That's got nothing to do with him being a defender of Hashem's glory. Right? To which the Torah says that's incorrect. Torah says, you know what this is? Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKoyen. His personality is Aaron's personality. Who was Aaron? As the Pirkei Avos tells us. Even more than Moshe Rabbeinu. Who was Aaron who when he died, they mourned for him double the time that they mourned for Moshe Rabbeinu? He was an Oyev Shalom, Veroid of Shalom. He was a man of love and a man of peace. That's Pinchas. So you should know that when he got up and he went and killed Zimri and Cosby, it was completely against his nature and he did it completely for the honor of Hashem. Which is an incredible lesson because sometimes one has to, there are many things we have to do for Hashem's sake. Some of them gel with our personality, some of them don't. Now, when they don't, most of the time, it's always good to grow, it's good to go against your personality, but it's good to do things that fit into our personality also, and that's okay. And even if we do a mitzvah in our self-interest, if someone gives tzedakah at the end of the day because they love giving tzedakah, even though one should give tzedakah even if they don't love it, but if someone gives it because they love giving tzedakah, that's okay. At the end of the day, it's a mitzvah, right? But there's one thing you can't do if you like doing, and that's being zealous, right? Being cruel for Hashem's honor, even if it's correct, you can't do unless you've checked that your motive is 100% pure. Because if you don't, then that kills the whole concept. It kills the whole process. Which is very interesting. I think I've shared this with you before many times, but I once heard from an uncle of mine, a Vort, that last week's parasha, when we have the story of Pinchas, it says that when all this was happening, it says, Vayar Pinchas saw what was happening, and he took a spear in his hand, and he went and he killed him. So I heard once from an uncle of mine, he said, this is the pshat in the pasuk. Vayar Pinchas saw, then he took a spear. Some people walk around with a spear the whole time. Like, where can we use it? You know what I'm saying? And then I'll find a good excuse, a holy excuse to use a spear. That's because they like using spears. They just need a good excuse. That's not legitimate. Pinchas didn't have a spear, meaning he didn't have a spear figuratively either. He didn't have it in his bones. He was a man of peace. He came from Aaron HaKohen. He didn't have any trace of cruelty in his personality. By Yar Pinchas, he saw, then he took a spear, and then he went for it. You understand? That's a different concept. All right. So that's the answer. The answer is that sometimes, first of all, in Yiddishkeit, so I once heard a good word that's in the Pirkei Avos, it says, Loi Tirtzach, you shouldn't kill, right? Although that's not actually the translation. Loi Tirtzach does not mean you shouldn't kill. Loi Tirtzach means you shouldn't murder. Murder means immoral killing. Killing is sometimes moral. Now, it's a tough thing to say, and a tough thing to obviously to check in, but there is a concept of the Torah gives room for capital punishment, although it's not used extremely often, and it was never used extremely often. There were wars where Jews were called upon to kill. There is moral killing sometimes when today modern Israel has to defend itself, they have to kill. Is it a good thing? No, but sometimes it's moral. So in Pinchas' case, because his motive was completely clear, because it was such a public desecration of Hashem's name, it was a moral thing to do, and therefore he did it, and it was a good thing, and he got rewarded, and he became a Kohen, and the plague stopped.
But the desecration had to do with immorality, not with idol worship.
Both. Both, because that whole story, if you look in Rashi, last week's parasha, every act of immorality came with idol worship. What they would do, what the women did was that when they seduced the men, then they got them to serve idolatry as well. The face of the public desecration was immorality. He came and he says, am I permitted to this woman? Can I marry her? And all that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's great. But it was linked to Avodah Zarah as well. Yeah. But immorality itself is also a terrible thing in public without idol worship.
It just seemed like no one tackled the idol worship.
Well, they did, because, in fact, we're going to bring this up in a second, because he wasn't the only one to die, Zimri. He was one to be killed by Pinchas, who went and killed him without a trial, without due process, right? But there were others that were caught with idol worship, and idol worship is capital punishment. And there were Sanhedrins then. In fact, more people died, we'll soon see, more people died in the process of trial and judgment than died in the plague. Yeah, according to Chazal. Okay. Now, that's not the point of the part of the parasha I want to focus on. The part of the parasha I want to focus on is the census that takes place after the story. Have a look on top of page 878. What comes just before what I'm about to learn is that Hashem speaks to Moshe Rabbeinu and he tells them to organize a war against the Midianim, right? The Midianites. Because they were responsible for this whole thing, which ended up in the whole story of Zimri and Cosby, which happened on the day of the plague. Then the pasuk continues, new chapter, pasuk Aleph on the top, it says, Vayehi acharei hamageifa. And it came after the plague. Now, by the way, what happens here is very unusual in the Torah. I think it's twice it happens in the Torah. You know that the Torah doesn't have chapters, right? But the Torah is divided into paragraphs. I think I've gone through this before. If you look in the Sefer Torah, you'll see that it's divided into paragraphs, like spaces and then paragraphs. That's how the Torah is divided up. Chapters came later. So the Torah is divided up into paragraphs, and also we have a tradition of how the verses are divided up, sukkim. Now, that's not obvious in the Torah. The paragraphs are obvious because there's a space. But the psukim are not obvious. We just have a tradition of where each pasuk begins and ends, right? And that goes all the way back to when the Torah was given. However, normally when you have a beginning of a paragraph, what we call a parsha, not parsha of the week, but like a parsha meaning as in terms of paragraph, it's always the beginning of a pasuk. In other words, you never have a paragraph starting in the middle of a sentence. With two exceptions, this is one of the exceptions. So if you look in the Chumash, you can see it the way it's in the Chumash. Right? Vayihi acharei hamageifa, top of page 878. And it happened, it was after the plague, space, paragraph, middle of the pasuk, middle of the thing. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, and Hashem said to Moshe, the El Elazar ben Aaron Hakoyan, and to Elazar the son of Aaron Hakoyan, because Aaron had already died by that point. Leimor is saying, let's go on. Su'u es reish kol adas b'nei Yisrael, count the heads of all the count the people. In other words, miben eshem shana v'mala, from 20 years onwards, the base of voicing for their families. Kol yoytzei tova b'Yisrael, count all the males that are of military age. That's how the census always takes place in Torah. The males of military age were counted from 20 years onwards. Right. Now, in fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a whole bunch of psukim with you, and I'm going to share with you three concepts, very interesting concepts on this whole. We don't often go into this, like these are kind of the paragraphs that get sort of glossed over a lot of times, but there's some very interesting things here. So let's just see how it plays out in the psukim. Vayedaber Moshe v'Elazar HaKohen nos ma'avos mo'ev al yadin reichel. Leimor Moshe Rabbeinu and Elazar HaKohen spoke to the Jewish people at Arvos Mo'ev. This is just before they went into Israel. Miben Eshem Shana v'Mala, they said from 20 years onwards, Kasher Tziva Hashem as Moshe, as Hashem has commanded Moshe. Of Nei Yisrael and the Jewish people, Hayotzim Be'eretz Mitzrayim. They're going to count all the people and the families as they went out of Egypt. Now, remember, this is almost 40 years after they left Egypt. This is like towards the end now, really, right? Aaron had already died. That's why it's Elazar helping Moshe, not Aaron. And it's Arvos Moav, which is just before they go into the land of Israel. Now, how are they enumerated here? So they're enumerated by families. So what the pasuk does is, it enumerates, it says the name of the tribe and then tells us the families of the tribe and then at the end gives us the number of the tribe, right? So for example, it says, Reuven b'chor Yisrael, Reuven who is the firstborn, B'nai Reuven, how do we know the children of Reuven? So, Chanoich, one of the children of Reuven was Chanoich. Mishpachas HaChanoichi, which came with the family of Chanoich. And it's called Mishpachas HaChanoichi. Lefalu, Mishpachas HaPalui. Lechetzro, Mishpachas HaChetzroini. Lekarmi, Mishpachas HaKarmi. You following me? Okay. That's how it's done. Now, I'm emphasizing it because you'll soon see there's a comment here in Russia which we need to learn. And Eile, Mishpacha is HaRuveini. And this is the whole family of Reuveni, Vahipukudayim, and their number was Shloisha Raboim Elef, 43,000 Shvameis, and 700 Shloisha and 30. Now, it just goes on, and it tells us about these families. That Rufnei Falu, you had the Falu, the Palu family. The sons of Palu was Eliov, and Bnei Eliov, and the sons of Eliov was Nemuel, Vedoson Vaaviram, and Doson and Aviram. Now, remember who Doson and Aviram were? They were the instigators of the Korach rebellion. Says the pasuk, "Who Dosan va'aviram?" That's Dosan va'aviram, Kriya Ha'eda. These prominent people, Asher Hitzu al Moshe ve'al Aaron, they instigated against Moshe and Aaron by Das Korach in the whole congregation of Korach. By Tzoysim al Hashem, and they went against Hashem. And says the pasuk, just in case you don't remember, "Vatiftach ha'aretz espia," the land opened up its mouth, "Vativ la'osam," and devoured them, "Ve'es Korach," and Korach, "B'Moshe Ha'eda," when that whole group died. Ba'achol ha'esh, and when the fire consumed es chamishim ha'masayim ish, the 250 people, va'yul anes, and it was an unbelievable sign. And then the Torah ends, uvenei koirach loy mesu, but the children of Koirach didn't actually die. Okay. Got the gist of it? Okay, now let me share with you three things, and the third one is an amazing thing, which I just learned myself this year. I've never gone into this part, and comes up with an unbelievable chiddush, an unbelievable thing which I wasn't aware of. I mean, don't pay attention to. But we'll get there. First of all, let's go. There's three Rashis that I want to learn, and I've copied them on the handout. So Rashi first of all quotes the beginning opening words here, and it says Vayhi acharei hamageifa. Right, very strange thing. It was after the plague, and then Hashem speaks to Moshe Rabbeinu, go and count the Jewish people. Now, as I said to you before, it's a strange phenomenon because it's a paragraph that starts in the middle of a sentence. Why does that? So the paragraph starts where it starts because it's a new concept. It's a new mitzvah. Go and count the Jewish people. It's a new topic. Right? However, the Torah does not start it at the beginning of a new sentence. The Torah starts at the middle of the sentence. The beginning of the sentence belongs to the previous paragraph, but obviously it's connected to this beginning of the paragraph because it's part of the same pasuk. And what is that? What is those first few words? Vayhi acharei hamageifa, was after the plague. In other words, what it teaches us is that the plague has been talked about in the previous paragraph, which has to do with the war of Midian, but the new paragraph, which talks about the counting, is obviously linked with the plague. It's a direct outcome of the fact that there was a plague. Says Rashi. Why? Vayhi acharei hamageifa, says Rashi. Moshel l'roya. You have that? That's on the handout. It's the first Rashi on the handout. Moshel l'roya. An analogy of a shepherd. Shenichnesu ze'evim l'soich edroi. Wolves came into his flock. V'horgu behen, and killed some of the flock. V'hu moina oisam, and he's counting them. The shepherd is counting them. Leida minyan hanoisorois, to know how many are left. In other words, the reason that the Yidden were counted yet again in this week's parsha was because they just suffered a plague. So to speak, after the plague, after Hashem's flock has been attacked, and some of the Yidden have died, it's now time to count them again, sort of to know how many are left. That's one interpretation. Another interpretation, Rashi says, Dover Acher, Kashi Yotzu mi Mitzrayim, when the Jews went out of Mitzrayim, V'nimsaru l'Moshe, and the Jews were given over to Moshe Rabbeinu to lead, Nimsar loy b'minyan, they were given over in the context of a census, right? Because the first census took place very soon after they left Egypt. So when Moshe Rabbeinu got the Jewish people, he got them with a census. Achshav Shakarev Lamus, now that the moment of Moshe Rabbeinu's passing is approaching, and it's time, and it's time for him to give back his flock, Machzirom B'minyan, he gives them back with a census. In other words, you gave it to me with a number, I give it to you back with a number. Is this what you gave me? This is what I'm giving you back. That's Rashi. However, interestingly enough, the first interpretation of Rashi is a little bit interesting because why do we need this whole analogy of a shepherd? In other words, Rashi is always very concise with his words, right? So what does the Rashi just say? It's very simple. This is linked to the plague. There was a plague. After a plague, we get a new census. Not how many are left. That's all there is. You don't need the whole thing with the shepherd. What's the whole? I mean, it's flowery. It's very beautiful. But what's the whole message here in the shepherd? Number one. Number two, we have a similar thing that happened once before. The Jewish people were counted after the story of the golden calf. Right? And there Rashi says, also gives a parable, but he says a little bit of a different one. He says that over there, it's a comparison to sheep, which are very beloved to its owner. And something happened, a disease happened in the sheep. So the owner of the sheep comes to the shepherd and says, can you do me a favor and count the sheep so I can know exactly what's left? Right? Bit of a different imagery. So it's Hashem being the owner of the sheep, coming to Moshe Rabbeinu after the Egel Azov and say, listen, they served the golden calf. There was an outbreak of punishment. A lot of them had to be killed, which was happened at there was a after the golden calf. There was also a tribunal, and they put people to death who served Avodah Zarah with witnesses. Hashem also then told Moshe Rabbeinu to feed them the solution of the ground up calf. If you remember correctly, once did this, and they drank it, and those that served the Egel Azov without witnesses also died. So there was a punishment. Hashem brought a punishment, right? So then what happened was, Hashem, who's the owner of the sheep, says to the shepherd, could you count them? Where here, Rashi has a different imagery. Rashi doesn't say that. Rashi says a shepherd that had a sheep, and something happened, the shepherd wants to count them. So why does Rashi change the imagery? Okay. So the Rebbe once explained in a Rashi talk. He used to talk about Rashi very often, and he said the following. He said, Rashi had a bit of an issue. Why actually is this census directly connected to the plague? And this is what I mentioned before. Rashi brings at the end of Parshas Balak that they didn't only die from the plague. Soon as people started rampantly serving idols, which is a clear capital punishment in the Torah, right away there were Sanhedrin that were set up. People were caught, brought to trial, convicted, and put to death because of the sin of idol worship. Right? And in fact, if you do the cheshbon, if you do the calculation of what Rashi explains of how many people were killed, that the judges, the various batei din, the various courts over there put people to death, more people died in the process of trial than that died, more than 24,000 people put to death, and therefore that's more people than what died in the plague. So if the pshat is that we have to count the people, we have to count the Jewish people after a whole bunch of people died, so why is it linked to the plague necessarily? Why don't we just link it generally to everyone that died? So Rashi says, no, it's a whole different counting here. Rashi says that this has got to do with a shepherd counting his flock. What does that mean? A shepherd counts the flock because he loves the flock, right? Because the shepherd feels responsible for the flock. Now, what happened was, Moshe Rabbeinu had a whole dilemma after this plague. He says like this, the people that died because they were put to death by trial, that's out of his control. He knows why they died. There's a specific in the Torah. They served idols. They were brought to court. They were brought to trial. There's a Sanhedrin. There's a process. That's what Hashem wants. That's out of my control. They served the idols. They were put to death. That's not my control. Okay. But the fact that I wasn't able to stop the plague, that bothers me. That bothers Moshe Rabbeinu. Because Moshe Rabbeinu says there was also a plague of people that weren't put through trial. That he needs to take responsibility for. Obviously, it also has to do with the fact that they sinned and Hashem brought the plague upon them and all that kind of stuff. But when it's Hashem's judgment, he can intercede. He can't interfere in the process. When judgment is given over to the human being, there's no interfering. As we know. We know that, for example, if someone commits a capital crime and is caught by a Sanhedrin, even if it's absolutely clear to the Sanhedrin that the person has done tshuva, it's out of their control. Hashem has a halacha. You brought him to trial. If the witnesses stack up, he's convicted, he gets put to death. There's no reason to find him innocent. If the facts are the facts, it doesn't matter if he's done tshuva, doesn't tshuva. Tshuva is in the eyes of God. However, we know that when we don't have a Sanhedrin and we do something that maybe deserves a capital punishment, but yet we're able to do tshuva, in heavenly punishment, tshuva works because Hashem is able to look into our hearts and to see how sincere we are. And the same thing with Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu many times in the Chumash was able to intercede on the Jewish people's behalf and to prevent divine punishment from happening. So the plague is what bothers him. It's not coming from Hashem, it's coming from him, because he's a roya, he's a shepherd. And that's why Rashi gives the analogy of a shepherd, and that's why that answers the question about the direct link to the plague. And that's why Rashi has to bring in the thing, bring in the analogy of the shepherd, because Rashi's question is, why is the census directly connected to the plague and not directed to the, just generally that people died? In Parshas Kisiso, by the Egel Azov over there, it says, he talks about the owner of the sheep. That's because that was Hashem's punishment. Hashem sent the punishment for the Egel Azov, and that was also out of everyone's control. And Hashem wanted to count them afterwards. Here, it's linked to the plague specifically. Says Rashi, that's because Moshe Rabbeinu wanted it, because he's the shepherd, and he loves the sheep, and therefore he felt very responsible. And out of his love and belovedness for the nation and for his flock, he counted them just to see what the damage was, as a shepherd would. Okay, so that's one concept. Now I want to show you another Rashi, very interesting Rashi, and I'll show it to you a Kliyokar on this Rashi. So we have this counting of the families, right? The counting of the families. And each family, it says, Chanoich, Mishpachas, HaChanoichi. So what happens is, if you look, each family gets mentioned twice, it gets the family, and then gets mentioned a second name, a second time with a Hey and a Yud on either side. Hey and a Yud. HaChanoichi is a Hey and Yud. HaPalui, Hey and Yud, right? Hey and Yud on the other side. Why is that? Says Rashi. Says Rashi, what happened was like this. Mishpacha HaChanoichi, says Rashi. Lefi shehoyu ha'umois mevazin oisa. The nations of the world used to scoff the Jewish people. And they would say like this. You know, you see the Jewish people, they do these census, right? So what do? They count everyone. And they put them into slots of tribes and slots of families, which are according to the father, correct? Because Jewishness is from the mother. Tribal lineage is from the father. Family lineage also from the father. So the nation would make fun. You see, they would say, look, you see these people? Ma elu misyachsin al shifteyen. These people, they slot in their lineage according to their tribes. Svurin haim, do they really think shalei shaltu hamitzrim be'imoyseyem, that the Egyptians, when they were in Egypt, the Egyptians didn't violate their mothers? Im begufam ayumoyshlim, if the Egyptians ruled and controlled their bodies, kal v'choymer b'nshoyseyem, how much more so were their wives? And we know Mitzrayim, Egypt, was an immoral society. Violence comes together with immorality. Look what's going on now with ISIS, right? That's what happens. Violence, indiscriminate violence, comes together with immorality. So do you really think that enslaving the Jewish people, oppressing them, getting them to work hard, breaking their bodies, didn't come together with taking advantage of their wives? So they are taking census all the time. They put themselves according to their father. They really think that every father they think is their father is their father? Right? This was the claim of the nations of the world. Lefikach, therefore, hitil HaKadosh Baruch Hu shmoy aleihem, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu put his name on every family. Hey mitzad zeh, v'yud mitzad zeh. A hey on the beginning of the family, a yud at the end of the family, loimer as if to say, meid ani aleihem. I give testimony, says Hashem. Shehem b'nei avoseihem, that these people are indeed the children of their fathers. And that the mothers were extremely protected, and the purity and the holiness took place even in Mitzrayim. Zeu mashem afurish al yedei David, and this is what it says by David HaMelech in Tehillim. It says that when David HaMelech is talking about the tribes of the Jewish people, it says in the pasuk Shiftei Ka, the tribes of God, Yud and Hey, which is he's alluding to the Yud and the Hey on either side of the families in this week's parasha. Eidus li Yisrael, it's a testimony to the Jewish people, which means Hashem Hazeh, this name, Meid Aleihem, testifies upon them, L'shifteyem, according to their tribes, L'fikach b'kulam k'siv, therefore with all the families it says, HaChanoichi, HaPalui, etc., etc. There was one exception, and this is mentioned by Rashi a few weeks ago. There was a woman called Shloimis Bas Divri, who was violated by an Egyptian, and had a child, and the child was known, and therefore he was the blasphemer. He ended up being the one who blasphemed a few weeks ago and got put to death. You know what I'm talking about? The Megadev, the end of Parshas Emor, I think it was. Emor? No, not Emor. End of Parshas, whatever, a few weeks ago. Which Parshas? I don't remember. Right? What happened? Because what happened was, he had a whole problem with having a portion of the land of Eretz Israel, and he had a problem even where to pitch his tent. He didn't belong to any tribe, because his father was an Egyptian. And without dealing with it properly, he didn't deal with it appropriately, and he started to blasphemed against God, and that was a capital sin. Okay. Shlomi's Bastiri, his name was. Yeah. No, that was the way the woman. What was his father? Doesn't say the son's name. She was from the tribe of Don, but her son didn't have a tribe because his father was Egyptian. Right? So a story that she went and he went to her house and he grabbed her and he violated her. And Rashi makes a comment there also that the Torah is not shy to publicize it and to mention it, because the Torah is actually saying that this was the one case that had happened, but other than that it never ever happened. And Hashem testifies to the fact by putting the hey and the yud on either side of the name. So the Kliyokra has a very interesting question. He says, it's all very nice, but why now? This is the last census. This is a story about Mitzrayim. These are the families that went out of Mitzrayim. There was a census after Mitzrayim. There was a census a year later. There was a census, a number of censuses after the Egel Azor, right? There were a number of times Yidden were counted. This was the last time before they went to Israel. Why now? Why did Hashem choose to do it now? He says a very interesting thing, and he says a few things. He says the following. He says, because now they needed the stamp of approval. Now when they went and failed with immorality, and they messed around with the daughters of Midian, so the Jews demonstrated a weakness in morality. So therefore the claim now of the nations suddenly came again, it's resurfaced and became a stronger claim. Therefore Hashem now in this sentence had to put his stamp, his divine stamp on the families and to say, no, these families are absolutely pure. That's why it's now. Then the Kliyokra says an interesting point. He says, why the hay first and then the yud? Right? Okay, I mean, grammatically it's not such a powerful question, because the Torah is saying, la chanoich mishpachas ha chanoichi, the chanoichi family, so the hay goes before the yud. But he says, if the whole idea is to put the hay and the yud, why the hay first? So he says, because the hay belongs to the woman and the yud belongs to the man. Right? As we know, yud and hay, yud is masculine, hay is feminine. Ish and isha, right? You know, the name of God that is in man and woman, the ish, they both have the, you know that, right? They're both the same letters, aleph and shin, with the yud and the hay. That's what that makes Hashem's name, if you bring God into a union, etc. But the yud is in the ish, the hay is in the woman. Yud is chachma, hay is bina, yud is small, hay is developed. So it's a whole, the same thing, masculine and feminine, right? So the hay is feminine, the yud is masculine. So he says, that's why the Torah puts the feminine one first, because the truth is that the reason that the Jews were completely protected and pure from immorality and from any violation was the women. As we know, he doesn't mention the Chazal, but the Chazal tell us that it was bischus nashim tzidkonios, that was in the merit of the righteous women that the Jews left Egypt. They were the ones that protected the family life. They were the ones that had actually got their husbands to live with them and have children altogether, because husbands were just beaten and downtrodden. They were the ones who protected themselves from being vulnerable and being violated by the Egyptians. So the truth is that although this is an amazing thing of the Jewish people, that they went through 210 years of Egypt and 86 of those years were terrible slavery, and yet they remained completely pure from a family point of view, really was mainly the schus of the women, and therefore the hay comes before the youth.
How did they manage to protect themselves from being violated by the Egyptians?
I guess the strength, the real strength, they were able to do that. They were able to make it very clear to the Egyptians that they cannot come close. Maybe it was like a culture they built up that this is like an untouchable thing. You're right, it's a good question. Maybe it was miraculous. I don't know what I'm saying, but it was obviously an incredible strength on the women's part more than the men. And that's what Hashem testified to by putting his name on the... Well, there was one incident. Well, there was Shlomis Bas Divri, but that also had to do with the fact. They also Rashi also brings, and the Kliyokra brings as well, that the women also took extra cautious measures of modesty to protect themselves. Right? Which Shlomis Bas Divri didn't do apparently, and Rashi mentions this in things Parshas Balos, whatever Parsha it is, and that's why she ended up yes being violated. But that was the one incident. Right? Then he makes an interesting point. If you have a look, I'll show you. If you have a look at the same page, 878, besides putting the yud and the hay on the names of the families, with Reuven, Hashem does it also with the whole tribe. If you have a look at the Pasuk Zion, verse 7, he says, Eile mishpachos ha-Reuveni. Right? These are the families of ha-Reuveni, so the whole tribe. He puts the hay and the yud, ha-Reuveni. Now, this actually Hashem only does with three of the tribes. He only does it with Reuven, Shimon, and Zvulun. The others have the hay and the yud on each family, but don't have them on the tribe. Why? The truth is you don't need them on the tribe. Once each family is pure, what do you need them on the tribe for? So, the Riyaka says a very interesting thing. He says, because these are the three tribes that need an extra stamp of approval. Why? Reuven, the person Reuven, I don't know if you remember from Bereshis, those of you who come for the Monday morning Bereshis, you remember this, that he committed a sin with the beds. He mixed up the whole beds with Bilhah and Zilpah. He did something that was really inappropriate, which his father was upset with him, and he had to spend a lot of time doing tshuva for, but it was associated with inappropriate behavior to do with morality, and therefore there was a weakness in that tribe, obviously, and therefore Hashem puts an extra yud and hay on Reuven. Shimon, of course we know why, because Shimon produced Zimri, who was the chief immoral leader in Parshas Pinchas. The whole story of Pinchas happened around Zimri, and therefore Shimon gets an extra stamp of approval. And Zvulun was an interesting thing. Zvulun, he says, because the Gemara tells us that Zvulun, by nature, the tribe of Zvulun, when they went into Eretz Yisrael, the tribe of Zvulun were sailors. They were business people. That's why they lived on the coast, and they would travel overseas by ship to do a lot of business. Sailors, the Gemara says, live a life where they're often apart. And therefore the temptation for immorality, both for the man and the woman, is much stronger. Because the family life is disrupted. Right? They live this and they travel for long, long periods of time. And therefore Hashem is giving that extra chizuk, so to speak. He's talking about his name being attached to the tribe, giving him extra energy of kedusha to be protected from that potential failure that could come dafk in the tribe of Zvulun because they're apart. But it's interesting as dafk those three tribes that get the yud and the hey, Reuven, Shimon, and Zvulun. Okay. Finally, I want to share with you something fascinating. At the end of Reuven, it goes through Dosan and Aviram. Dosan and Aviram comes from Reuven. Torah makes mention of the story of Korach. And then out of the blue, the Torah says, by the way, the sons of Korach did not die. Okay? Now, sons of Korach, by the way, did not belong to Reuven. You understand? Korach was a Levi. Right? But the Torah just says over here, the sons of Korach didn't die. Now, it mentions it in context because Dasan v'Aviram. Dasan v'Aviram were the people who ran the machalikas with Korach. They inflamed the whole thing. And Hashem punished them and they were devoured by the earth and some people were burnt. And by the way, talking about the story of Korach, says the Parasha, Uvnei Korach le'meisu, the sons of Korach didn't die. Says Rashi. The last Rashi on the handout. Uvnei Korach le'meisu. The sons of Korach didn't die. Says Rashi, actually, heim hoyu be'etz atchila. They did not die because they weren't guilty completely. In fact, they were guilty. They were part of the plan to begin with. Heim hoyu be'etz atchila. They were part of the rebellion, the whole plan, the scheme. They were part of it, the sons of Korach. However, u'b'shas ha'machlokes, at the time of the conflict, hirharu tshuva belibam. They thought they had feelings of tshuva in their heart. Right? Lefikach, therefore, look what Rashi says now, Nizbatzer lohem mokem gevoya begeinam. Hashem fortified a special place for them, a higher place in Gehinnom. Now Gehinnom normally means hell, but the Mefarshim say over here it means when Korach's family was swallowed up by the ground. So it says v'yardu chayim sha'ola, the whole family and all the people that were swallowed up by the ground, they went all the way deep down to the depths of the earth. They were killed there. The sons of Korach also swallowed up, apparently, according to this Rashi. But because they had feelings of tshuva, they didn't die. And instead, what Hashem did was, he gave them a spectator's position underground there. He gave them a special fortified, strengthened place underground, and they didn't die. And they lived there, and they stayed there. Very strange Rashi, right? First of all, what does this mean? So what does it mean? They stood there till when? Did they die eventually? They come up again, like. What actually happened here? What are we talking about? Now, this concept, there are like 5-6 questions on this whole thing, on this Rashi, which I'm going to share with you. And then give you an amazing answer. This is also linked to a Rashi in the Parsha of Korach. Rashi has a long Rashi, I'm not going to do it inside, there's a wrong Rashi there. Rashi talks about the whole machlokes of Korach. And Rashi poses a question. Says Korach was a smart man. Korach was a great man, actually. So Rashi says, Rashi, ma ro l'shtuse. How did he get trapped in this ridiculous scheme of going against Moshe? He didn't think he's going to die. He didn't think he's going to be punished. What was with him? Says Rashi, Korach, being such a great man, saw into the distant future and he saw that Shmuel Hanavi, the great Shmuel Hanavi, who by the way was so great that in Tehillim it compares him to Moshe and Aaron together, Shmuel Hanavi would sing praises to Hashem, and Shmuel Hanavi was a descendant of Korach. So what it seems like, at the time Korach had children, we know this because it says talks about here the children of Korach. At the time Korach had children, but they hadn't married yet, and then and they didn't have their own children. So Korach thinks to himself, listen here, I'm okay, because my family, okay, my family joined this machlokes, that's their problem, they're going to take care of themselves, but I'm okay, because I know I have to stay alive, because I got to still have children, whose children have to have children, and I know that Shmuel Hanavi has to come out of me. So I'm safe. That's what Rashi says. What was his mistake, says Rashi there? Rashi doesn't articulate it the same way as he does here, but Rashi says that he didn't realize that at the last moment his children were going to do tshuva. Which if you just learned that Rashi, it would appear to mean his children were going to do tshuva, not be punished, be kept alive completely, and they'll continue on, and Shmuel Hanavi will come out of them. Right? So Korach died, but his children...
Couldn't Korach figure that out?
What, his children were going to do tshuva?
No, couldn't Korach figure out that it would either be him or his kids?
Yeah, but his children would be punished, not him. He felt he was safe. Yeah, that's true, but okay, you know, listen, he definitely got involved, but no, but Rashi wants to, what's Rashi is trying to figure out, like, where did this whole, I mean, must have some craziness in your head, some rationale, right? The problem is, it doesn't gel with this Rashi, because this Rashi seems to say that the children of Korach were also swallowed up. Okay, they got swallowed up, and they got some sort of box primary seat over there under the ground, but it doesn't do well for family life. I mean, that's not going to get them children. So, what actually happened here? Right. So you must say that eventually they came up from the ground. They didn't die. So why did they go down in the first place? So let me just first of all go through all the questions on this Rashi. Number one, what does Rashi mean? Heim hoyu be'etzah tchila. They were initially part of the scheme. That language actually seems to suggest not they were just part of the scheme, but they actually were the schemers of the scheme. And in fact, that becomes the whole discussion over here with Dasan and Aviram. Eitzot Chila means that they were like in the beginning, they were in the forefront of this rebellion. So it looks like Korach's children actually weren't just part of the whole thing. They didn't just swept up with the whole plan. They actually were the leaders of this rebellion against Moshe Rabbeinu. Then Rashi says, interesting, every word here of Rashi is exact. Rashi says, at the time of the conflict, they did tshuva. Shas hamachlekes, the time of the conflict. What does that mean, the time of the conflict of the tshuva? What does that mean? Why does Rashi just say they did tshuva? Obviously, the time or at the end or before, whatever the case is. Right? So it looks like, number one, they didn't do tshuva before the conflict happened. It looked like they did tshuva while it was happening. Right? And also, what does this mean? So what does it mean? Like, in other words, the rebellion was still going on, and they were thinking tshuva. But what do they do with that tshuva? And also, what does it mean they thought tshuva? They thought tshuva. They were only thinking tshuva. They didn't articulate, they didn't verbalize it. So we see, we're starting to get a little bit of what's happening here. They were the instigators of this machlekes, together with Dasan and Aviram. B'shas ha-machlekes, as the conflict is going on, they're having feelings of tshuva, which they're not articulating.
Second thoughts,
but they're having feelings of, they want remorse, they think this is wrong, but they somehow didn't articulate it. Now, is that a deficiency in tshuva? Not necessarily, because the Gemara tells us that if someone thinks real thoughts of tshuva, you can become transformed from a wicked person to a righteous person. That's tzadik gomer, right? We know this from a legal thing. If someone marries a woman, it says in the Masechta Kiddushin, and he makes a condition, he gives her the ring and he says, I'm marrying you, but on condition you're a tzaddik. Even if this person is a well-known wicked person, we worry that maybe she's legally married and she might require a get, because maybe he marries her and he says on condition, I'm a tzaddik gomer. She might require a get, because maybe before he gave her the ring, maybe he had feelings of tshuva. No one knows about it, because we only know him as a low life, but maybe he had feelings of tshuva, which would be enough to make him legally married. That would be enough for him to be legally achieving his condition, which is to be a tzaddik. So nothing wrong with feelings of tshuva, but why is it necessary to emphasize it, right? The other thing we need to know is, what is this pasuk doing here? Uvnei Korach loy meisa, the children of Korach didn't die. Why is that here? It belongs in the parasha of Korach. If we need to know that the Korach children didn't die, it belongs in that parasha. If it does belong here, it doesn't belong here, it belongs later. Later, we have the counting of the tribes of Levi, where it talks about the families of Korach, which obviously we would stop and think, hold on, families of Korach, I thought the families of Korach all were died, so therefore we should have had the pasuk right over there, which is a couple pages later, Uvnei Korach lames, the children of Korach didn't die. Right? Why is it here? This is such an out-of-place pasuk. Now, going back to what we said before, we have to conclude one thing. That if Korach's children were indeed swallowed up, they must have come back at some point of time. The question is when. They must have come back and got married and had children. Why? Because of that Rashi in Parshas Korach. The whole thing is that Korach thought that he would stay alive. He died, but Shmuel was going to come out of him, and they needed to have children for that. So what happened, if you put the two Rashis together, what happened was the sons of Korach were swallowed up with the rest of the family of Korach, given a box seat there up just underneath the surface of the thing, and then they came back up somehow, and they had children, and then... So when did that happen exactly, right? Now, don't forget, this pasuk is almost 40 years after the story of Korach. The story of Korach and Shlach and the Meraglim all happened when they were supposed to go to Eretz Yisrael, which was not long after they left Egypt, a year later, right? This happened, this Parsha Pinchas happened almost 39 years later, as they were about to go into Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so you realize there's a gap between, like 39 years between Korach and this pasuk. So the Rebbe in one of the sikhs explained the most unbelievable chiddush, which you don't think of this unless you actually analyze it like this, right? He said what happened was like this. They sinned. The sons of Korach sinned tremendously. Why? Eitz Tchila. They were not just part of it. They were really part of it. Number one. Number two, they had thoughts of tshuva. Now let's imagine the thoughts of tshuva were sincere, but there was a problem. The problem is Moshe Rabbeinu came and said, and he said like this, that machloikas, dispute, conflict is a terrible thing. Hashem is going to create a special new creation, i.e. the mouth of the earth, as he calls it, which will swallow up all those involved. And if Hashem doesn't do that and punish everyone, I've made this Torah up, says Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? Now Korach's children have a real dilemma, have a real problem. They did tshuva, but it wasn't properly, because what happened was they were too scared. They did tshuva in their heart, but they didn't tell anyone about it. And they didn't leave the machlokes. That's what Rashi says, b'sha'as ha-machlokes, at the time when the conflict was still going on, they had thoughts of tshuva, shkoyach, but you had thoughts of tshuva, but it's machlokes is still going on. For all public perception purposes, Hashem knows you've done tshuva, true, nice guys, but for all public perception purposes, you are still very much part of the machlokes. And Moshe Rabbeinu promised that all those that are part of the machlokes, as a sign to everyone that being involved in such a machlokes is a terribly dangerous thing, everyone will witness the swallowing up and the demise of this family and this group of people. Who's going to witness it, says Rashi, an amazing thing? Kol ha'eda, all the congregation that was present. Which congregation was present at the time of Korach? The ones that went out of Mitzrayim. How long did it take for the whole congregation went out of Mitzrayim to disappear? 40 years, until they're about to go into Eretz Yisrael. So until the last guy died, these guys needed to be underneath the ground. Right? So you imagine, so it's a miraculous thing. They were sent under the ground. They lived there. Vayesha, they lived there. They obviously traveled around the people, they had moved on since Korach's times, right? So they were obviously traveling underneath the Jewish people, under the ground, right? Which is why this thing is in this week's, is this parasha. You can't put this pasuk in Parshas Korach, because we don't need to know in Parshas Korach the sons of Korach didn't die. It's not relevant. What's relevant in Parshas Korach is that they did die. In other words, they went under the ground. That's what's relevant. Because that's what everyone needed to know. They went under the ground. What we need to know in our parasha is that they didn't die. Although they went under the ground, they didn't die. What do you mean they didn't die? They came upstairs later, and they had children. They married, they had children, and there was a family of Korach, which we have by Levi, right? Okay. So that answers all the questions. So the way it works is like this. Hashem mentions here, Korach, we need to know one thing. Korach, anyone that was involved in Machlokes died. or swallowed up by the ground. That's taken care of. That's the story of Korach, including the sons of Korach. Now, in our parasha, we need to know that the Korach sons actually didn't die. They were swallowed, but they didn't die. They came up, right? So where did Hashem put it? Hashem says, let me explain to you what's happening here. We're going to learn about Dasan Vaviram. Dasan Vaviram inflamed the whole machlokes. And by the way, the sons of Korach didn't die. It says Hashem, I'm putting it here, not later. Not by Levi, not in Korach, and not later by Levi. Because I want you to know how guilty they were. I want you to know they actually instigated the machlokes. They were buddy-buddy with Dasan Vaviram. They're in the same group as Dasan Vaviram. They started the thing, which is why they got swallowed up. However, says the Prasha, they Korach lemeis, they didn't die. Because at the end of the day, they did shiva. Therefore, what happened was, the Torah puts it not in Korach, it's not relevant there, not by Levi, because he wants to put it by Reuven, because by Reuven were the people who started the whole thing, Dasan and Baviram and all the Reuven people. And therefore, it's here. And therefore, what happens is, what we learn from this whole thing, putting it all together, that they had to be swallowed up because they actually appeared to be part of the instigation of the whole machlokes. They didn't display their tshuva. That's what Rashi says, that they did it in their heart. It might have been complete, but it was in their heart. They didn't walk away. They were too scared to walk away. Therefore, they really had to be punished. They were sent underground, but given a peaceful life there. They traveled around with the Jews, and they came up. When did they come up? 40 years later. And then they married and had children. And the Rebbe, and that answers all the questions of Rashi. The Rebbe concludes this. You see, this is the power of tshuva. That although they actually did something really terrible, in their case, really, they should have actually, yes, walked away. They should have verbalized the tshuva. They should have walked away. They should have fought the system. They should have not conformed. Right? But they were too scared to do it. And therefore, they were punished. But at the same time, at the end of the day, they did tshuva. And because they did tshuva, Hashem saved them, miraculously kept them alive for the 40 years, brought them back afterwards, and they were able to marry and have children. And they weren't just a family of Korach. But if you look in Tillim, you'll see the family of Korach became a very, very prominent family. The B'nai Korach, the sons of Korach, which we learn here, they didn't do a complete shiva. They didn't walk away and they were punished, but they did shiva. They authored praises to Hashem, which later became part of Tehillim. If you look at some chapters of Tillim, it starts with the words, Livnei Korach, the sons of Korach, Mizmor. David HaMelech took praises from other ways. Tillim is not only with David HaMelech. There are, I think, 10 authors of Tillim. Right, Tov HaMelech put it all together. But one of the authors of Tillim is the B'nai Korach. And they sang praises to Hashem, and they ended up having Shmuel Hanavi. Shmuel Hanavi became the descendant. Shmuel Hanavi was as great as Moshe and Aaron put together. Right? Why? Because at the end of the day, as low as you fall, and as terrible as it sometimes is, even if it has to come with certain consequence, as it did in the case of the B'nai Korach, but the power of tshuva is never lost. Even a partial tshuva is never lost. And tshuva can always bring back a person to tremendous heights. Okay.